I have got a joke for you. It's, you might have heard it. It's a joke. I asked my my wife asked me if it's in the dog bowl. I said, I didn't know you played cricket.
Cue the music.
Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge podcast. I'm Rhys, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
And I'm Will. I'm a historian who knows nothing about geography.
And we are on a quest to fill each other's
gaps in knowledge.
So we're going to go straight into Misconception Corner, and I think it's me to start this week for the geography stuff. So my question for Misconception Corner for you is, where is the central business district of the Philippines?
Ooh, Philippines. I'm thinking Manila, which is the capital of the Philippines, as far as I know.
Okay. Got him. Straight away.
Nice. What it's here for.
Do you know anything about Manila?
It lends its name to a kind of envelope, I think.
Really?
A Manila envelope. Is that a thing?
Oh, this is news to me.
I feel like that's the thing.
Apart sounds like that, it should be a thing.
You can tell that I am, that scraping sound you hear is the bottom of the barrel of my knowledge.
Well, I can tell, this is what's interesting about, so Manila we know as is the capital of the Philippines. However, Manila is a huge city, but it's actually kind of just like a province of, or a district of a whole metropolis area. So Manila is where the capital city is, and actually is the most densely populated city in the world.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and the statistic is there's 1.8 million people, and get this, 48,000 people per square kilometer.
That's a lot of people in a square kilometer.
It is. That's
wow.
Just tall buildings.
48,000.
Yeah, that's gosh, like a Premier League football stadium.
Me being a hobbit, I don't think I've ever seen 48,000 people in my life.
No, probably, because yeah, no, that's a lot of people to see, especially at once as well.
Jeez.
Yeah, but it's, so Manila, which is on the west coast of sort of northwest of Philippines, but it isn't considered like the business capital of the Philippines at all. It's literally just next door, though, in a city called Makati.
Makati.
So Makati is Makati. Mm-hmm. And this is just southeast of Manila. So it's still part of, like, do you know London is like you have London and Greater London, and it gets a bit confusing, which is like the government area and so on. This is kind of what this is. So it's still kind of part of Manila, but it is identified as its own urban area and city. And the other parallel I can make is a bit like Johannesburg and Pretoria in South Africa, where the city's just merged into one, but they're two different cities.
Are they that close together?
Yeah, they're like on top of it. They've grown into one another as an urban area.
Huh.
Yeah. So
that's you found a gap in my knowledge, because yeah. I actually thought that Joburg and Pretoria were quite far apart.
No, they've merged into one.
Right.
Some South Africans are saying, no, that's really wrong, Rhys. But I'm pretty convinced that's yes.
I was going to do a very bad South African accent then.
All it is.
when it comes to certain accents, do you find that you've got like a single word to get you into that accent?
Yeah, no, that does exist. Interestingly, for Australia, I just find if you say I'm Australian, you can that's quite a nice segue in.
That works. Yeah. And for Jamaican, it's of course beer can.
Yeah, beer can.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gets you going.
Mine for South African is just a racist.
It's very topical. It's very topical.
But it does work.
Does work.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It does work when you get speaking like a South African.
Exactly.
So Makati, which is the business center or financial center of the Philippines, mm-hmm. is where the central business district of the Philippines is. You may have heard the central business district sometimes referred to as the CBD.
CBD.
Yeah, we're not to be confused with cannabis oil.
No.
Which is uses the same initials.
Yeah.
But that's the CBD of the Philippines, and where most of the financial doings occurs. It's got the highest concentration of multinational and local corporations in the country, major banks, corporations, department stores, and the most foreign embassies is in this area.
Right. So it's kind of like a Netherlands situation where the capital city isn't really the capital city.
Pretty much, yeah. It's uh-huh. Yeah, so it's places like Australia, if I'm not like Canberra, which is, you would think like Sydney or Melbourne should be the capital, but they couldn't decide between them. So they said, right, we're going to have a government place Yeah, where we have all the government buildings. A bit like Brazil is the same as well.
Yeah.
With Brasilia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, that's kind of what you do with squabbling children, isn't it? If you can't decide between yourselves, then neither of you get it.
Yeah.
And we'll give it to Canberra.
Give it to Canberra instead. You just reminded me. So my nan, when my mum and my uncle, they used to fight over like pieces of cake. Her technique to make it fair was if there was a piece of cake, one would cut and one would choose. That's a very good motherly
technique.
It's a
good way of doing it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That stops all the fighting.
It does.
And it encourages careful cutting.
It does. Yeah.
But there is another place. I'll just say, you know, Makati also has, it's also the big Philippine Stock Exchange. It also exists there. So it's kind of a wealthy place, really. But it has 630,000 people, and it has density which is significantly less at 29,000 people per square kilometre.
Still quite a lot of people in a single square kilometre.
It is, yeah.
Wow.
But there is also, it has a university. The poverty rate is only 0.28%.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's a relatively wealthy area. So this is, yeah, the financial centre and the business area is Makati in the Philippines. There's also a place called Taguig, I think it's pronounced. And that's not far away, well, from this area of Makati. And that is also kind of like the other financial place as well from the Philippines. That's just further south. So the further south you go from Manila, the capital, that's where the business area starts to exist. And I think Manila is more of the historical kind of capital city of the Philippines.
Okay. And if Reese has absolutely murdered any Filipino place names there, please do tell us. Please do get in touch.
Well, here's the thing. I would like to know. So have you heard of something called a barangay before?
No, I haven't.
So this is... So
you have a glint in your eye.
Well, I had to be careful how I say it because it is, as it's written down, it looks like barangay.
Barangay.
Which just looks a lonely homosexual.
Hell of a dry spell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But so barangays, I think, is how you might say it in the Filipino language. But what this is, they have... So imagine the Holy Roman Empire, God, history, Jesus Christ.
Here we go.
Where they have now all the tiny little states.
You love it.
Yeah. And it's a whole mess across Central Europe.
Yeah.
It's kind of what that is in Manila. That's what the barangays are. They're little village sort of like council places and where like governments and are. And they're tiny little villages and they all make up like districts, which then make up the city of Manila.
Aha, uh-huh. So lots of little kind of neighborhoods.
Pretty much, yeah. And they're called barangays. So for example, I think in Manila, there's like 1,000 of them.
Uh-huh.
Like it's...
Okay.
It's like they're tiny, tiny things that they make up the districts and the whole city of Manila. They're called barangays.
Interesting.
It's quite a cool little name. And I had to make sure. I hope I've said that right. Someone should let me know if I haven't.
Because we're really racking up the countries we can't go into now.
We are.
Don't want to ostracize the Philippines as well.
Absolutely not. No. We need to be on their side, I think. We're going to run out of countries, I think.
We are.
But yeah, that's the Philippines. There was one thing I wanted to say a little bit about Manila. Did you know it's called the Pearl of the Orient?
The Pearl of the Orient?
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's quite fancy.
That is quite fancy.
And it's the second largest city in the Philippines, and it is Quezon or Quezon City, which is the highest population. It's a bit further north, actually. But Manila actually means where indigo is found, which is quite cool.
Isn't that lovely?
It's lovely. So there's several plant species there where the colour can be extracted for dye, historically, I imagine. Yeah, but that's what Manila means.
So why is the CBD separate from Manila? Do you know?
I don't know exactly what, but it's not unusual for cities, like capital cities, not to be the central business area. So even Germany is a great example of that. So Berlin is like the historical capital, but you have to go to Frankfurt for there to be the business capital. I think a lot of this is to do with its accessibility, how far it's developed, and if it has universities, particularly has high-tech universities, they usually develop as a financial center. So that's quite a common thing to happen. But it's not the case around the whole of the world. Like London, for example, is also the...
Paris, Vienna.
Exactly, yeah. But there are some countries where you might have historical capitals, or the capital city changes as well. And that's quite a common thing as well. I don't know the specifics of Manila and Makati. Almost forgot it then. But having looked at a map and did a bit of research, there are some universities in this area. So they have a big pool of youthful, intelligent, knowledgeable, highly qualified people.
Hang on a minute. Are you being paid by the Maybe. McCarty Tourist Board over here?
Maybe. No comment. No comment.
When do I see my check?
So, Will.
Okay.
Are you going to lower me into your misconception corner?
I am indeed, yes. And my bait is you as a son of Kent.
Yes.
Presumably know about Hastings.
I do.
And the battle thereof.
Yes.
Which took place in the town of?
Can I say the year?
No. You heard the question and you'll answer it.
Oh, no.
The year was, of course,
1066.
Correct. That is not my misconception.
Okay, so that's in stone. We know that.
We know that.
Okay.
Where did the Battle of Hastings take place?
It's obviously common. I'm going to say Hastings.
Would you like to try again? I'll give you a clue. The answer is in Battle of Hastings.
Battle?
Correct.
Oh!
There we go.
I was in there. Now, I just want to say one thing. I had an inkling. Being a man of Kent, I'd like to think that a lot of my listeners from Kent or my mates will look at me and go, how the hell did you not know that,
Reece? Trying to backtrack?
Right.
All right, fine. Let's do a quick Kentish quiz then.
Oh, no!
The Kentish horse is called?
Invicta.
Okay, fine. And that's all I know about
Kent. Oh, yes, 100%, and you're a Kent test.
Yeah, no, Battle of Hastings took place in battle.
Uh-huh.
So that's why the abbey where William the Conqueror built his abbey afterwards is called Battle Abbey. Because it's near Hastings and near enough that we know it as the Battle of Hastings, because the Battle of Battle, come on.
This is my question. What came first? The name, the word battle to mean to fight, or the town battle? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, the town was named after the battle. The place battle was called battle because the battle took place there.
Oh, God, it's a lot of battles. It's starting to mean nothing now.
Just
word.
To really irritate our listeners, battle, 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 battle. Of course. Yeah. So, Battle of Hastings took place in 1066. We'd like a second misconception.
Oh, go on. I'm ready.
It's not just misconception corner here. It's misconception motorway.
Oh, God. I don't know. What's after that?
Misconception dead end? I don't know. How did Harold Godwinson die?
Oh. I want to say arrow in the eye. But
arrow in the eye is the classic misconception.
Oh,
got him again.
No.
2 for 2.
Oh, God.
Beautiful. Knocked him out of the park. No, I mean, it's a bit of a trick question because we don't actually know how he died.
Is it like a tapestry in the Bay of Tapestry?
It is, yeah, it's in the Bay of Tapestry. Yeah, exactly. And some of the later accounts from about the 12th century, so about 100 years later, say he was killed by an arrow in the eye. But what we think is they saw it from the Bay of Tapestry instead.
Oh, okay, I see.
So the most contemporary account, which was written about 4 months after the battle by a guy called Guy of Amiens, who was Norman, as you can guess, said that he was chopped down by 4 knights at once.
That's bloody.
Like your bathroom days in Brighton.
It does sound like my bathroom days in Brighton, actually. You're right.
Yeah. The Bay of Tapestry is this enormous long tapestry. It's about 150 meters long. And it's like a cartoon strip of the whole of the Norman invasion. And this part of the Bay of Tapestry, towards the end of the Battle of Hastings, or the Battle of Battle of Battle of Battle, if you... Will,
battle, battle, battle.
Which I won't, but you can. You have hic Harold Rex Interfectus Est, which means, as of course everyone knows, here Harold the King is killed.
Right.
Trouble is, that's quite a long phrase to have on a cartoon, and so it doesn't just go over a single character. And so you might be picturing it in your mind's eye if you know this part of the Bay of Tapestry.
I can actually picture it. I just want to get this right. Mm. Is he facing, as it were, left to right? Or is that wrong? Or is
he's facing stage right? He's facing what we would call left.
Okay. I see. Right.
So you've got a figure standing towards the left, underneath hic Harold, which means here Harold, and he's wearing chainmail and he's got his head pulled back and one hand up towards his eye, and we think there may have been an arrow in his hand at some point. It's missing from the tapestry now, unfortunately. And it could have been added much, much later. It's not entirely clear whether or not there was an arrow originally, but either way, underneath here, Harold, you have a man with his hand up towards his eye, in a kind of eye being gouged out by arrow kind of pose.
Yeah.
The only thing is, under Interfectus Est, which means is killed, you have a completely different guy, and we know he's different because he's got different socks on. The first guy's got plain socks. This guy's got hoop socks.
Oh, fancy.
And the biotapestry is full of fantastic, fancy details like that. Okay. Like towards the end, you've got, in the bottom, you've got scavengers coming onto the battlefield, stealing all the clothes off the naked, dead English people.
Oh, wow. Okay. Things like looting
that.
And...
Yeah, this... exactly.
Okay.
It's full of some great details. But this guy, Interfectus S, with his different socks, is being chopped down by a knight and mangled by a horse. A horse is just running over him.
Oh, okay.
So under the phrase, here, Harold the King is being killed, you've got two different people being killed in two completely different ways. And the contemporary accounts, well, the contemporary account says he was killed by four knights, not one knight. So that differs from the biotapestry. And the later accounts say he was shot by an arrow in the eye.
Wow. The problem they have here is there's no live footage of it, is there?
No, the biotapestry is as close as you're going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... who knows how he was killed? Either way, when he was killed, his body was completely mangled. The only way that they could figure out which body Harold Godwinson's was after the battle was his wife, a woman called Edith Swanneck, which is a beautiful
What name. A name that is, Swanneck.
Also quite disturbing to yeah. imagine.
Why? Hang on.
2 meter long neck. It's because she was so pale, because she was so white.
Oh, I see.
And of course, this is, up until very, very recently, the whiter you are, in white predominant societies, it signifies you don't have to work outside.
Oh,
it
signifies
that you're rich. Exactly.
Yes.
So getting a tan is a very, very recent thing because it signifies you don't have to work inside. You can spend all your time out on the ski slope.
I see. Well, this is really interesting. So when I've noticed that in Western cultures, it's quite common for us to get a tan. People like to look tan. It's seen as attractive. But if you go over to Asian cultures, they like Japan, for example, they try and have whiter, more pale skin. And that's that kind of their makeup is designed around that to have a more pale look. And it's quite a crazy cultural difference from the East and the West there.
And I do wonder if that will shift for those cultures in the future as well as outdoor farming, agricultural communities develop into more service-based communities, because that's the change that happened here, of course. And so now if you look pasty and pale, it's because you're stuck inside at a desk job all day. Whereas if you look all tan, it's because you can afford not to. But that's Edith Swanneck. She has a beautiful white neck, like a swan, I guess. And the only way she can identify Harold Godwinson's body is because he's got some moles on it. And she just happens to spot a specific mole on his body. The rest of it, his face, his limbs, any other kind of identifying features have been completely mangled.
Is Mrs. Swanneck, is that your husband? I don't know. But I need to look for his moles. Like, how mangled must your body
be? You mean you can't tell from this mangled pile of mints? But the thing is, she said to William the Conqueror, Duke William of Normandy, soon to be William the First of England, can I have his body? I want to take it back to his mother and bury it. And William said, no, you cannot have his body because he was a traitor and he doesn't deserve a Christian burial. And we're going to leave his body out for the dogs, which is the most aggressive way you can treat a human being after their death in Christianity. Because if they're not buried, they can't be resurrected. So you've damned his soul for eternity.
Wow.
That's how much he hated him.
Or it was just a big logistical problem being mangled and he couldn't get the horses and carts to take them away in separate bags.
They didn't have plastic bags at this point in time.
All right, okay.
Bag for life were about 1,000 years off. Yeah, so Battle of Hastings didn't take place in Hastings, did take place in Battle, and you can go visit Battle Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a nice funicular in Hastings.
Is there?
Yeah.
I'm a fan of a good funicular.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. You go up, it's only a short one, it takes about 2 minutes to go up, and then you can look over the coast from the top and in the English Channel.
Nice.
Yeah.
I can only think of two funicular things. One is funicular railways. Do you know what the other funicular thing is?
No.
When you go to a hotel and you have a buffet breakfast.
Right.
And you get your untoasted bread.
Yes.
You have those pop-up toasters.
No, it goes through a machine.
And that is called a funicular toaster.
Oh!
Because it's on rails.
Of course it's on rails, yeah.
Yeah.
Does it go choo-choo as it goes through?
No, you go choo-choo when you're eating your toast.
There we go.
Of course.
Okay, so let's go straight into the main gap filler of Let's Go the Gap, and this is a joyful one. So I've called this one Backflipping Out of Poverty. So we are talking today about how circuses are getting the marginalized youth out of poverty, crime, and violence. But it's a nice story, and it's a nice thing that's happening. So we're going to go to two countries here. We're going to start in Guinea, and then we're going to head down to South Africa, which we've already talked about already today. So there's a place in Guinea called Conakry, and here they have a circus called the Tinafan Circus. And what this Tinafan Circus is, it's kind of like, do you know where Guinea is?
In West Africa. Is it the one that's surrounded by Senegal?
No, that's the Gambia.
That's the Gambia.
That's the Gambia, yeah. And it's literally the... just while we're on this, do you know how they decided the borders of the Gambia?
I do, but I'm going to let you tell the story.
Okay, it's fun. It's shooting a cannon from either side of the Gambia River, and it's about 22 miles either side.
Which is so weird.
such a weird way to make borders of a country. But yeah, so it is in West Africa. So what we have here is a Tinafan Circus where they have some of the most skilled trained circus acrobats of the world, and they train them here in Guinea. And the idea is here is that a lot of Guinea will have a lot of problems financially and economically, and a lot of the youth do not have a lot of opportunities in these areas to develop and develop as have a way of life or have a job prospect or a career. And quite often they turn to crime, they turn to drugs, and so on. And the youth are commonly described as marginalized from society. And one of the ways in which people have been trying to get them out of this is through this circus training. They are when you think circus, what comes to mind?
I'm thinking of a big top, essentially. I'm mm-hmm. thinking specifically the one that comes to mind is as you would drive into Duisburg, where I live, just next to the Hauptbahnhof, there was a permanent circus set up that lasted for about 3 months. Mm-hmm. And there was this, so not permanent in the slightest, it's an enormous big top, mm-hmm. essentially, and jugglers, elephants, the whole shebang.
So what you're describing is maybe something like the Canada-based, the Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah, Cirque du Soleil. Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen them?
I haven't seen the Cirque du Soleil, no.
I've been lucky enough to see them. That's the only circus that I would abide.
Okay. So from this Tinafan Circus, they have trained two people to perform in the... can you say it again? Because you said it really well.
Cirque du Soleil.
Cirque du Soleil.
Mm, très bien.
So, yeah. I don't know any French.
Okay.
That's Spanish. But they've trained, so the Tinafan Circus, which is in Guinea, they actually have two people that have been taken in by these...
Cirque du Soleil.
Thank you. You're going to have to say this if I put my finger up.
Cirque du Soleil.
Thank you. You have to say it, okay? So the Tinafan have two people in the...
Cirque du Soleil.
Circus in Canada. Yeah, and obviously this is the biggest and best circus in the whole of the world.
Mm-hmm. That's a hell of an achievement. That's like the Harlem Globetrotters.
Pretty much, yeah. But there are a lot of these performers, they go around the world, New York, Tokyo, and so on. They're globally known. But there are obviously other circuses around the world as well. But this Tinafan Circus, which is in Guinea, is what they call a social circus. So the idea is actually it's a lot of street performers.
Right.
Where a lot of people come around to watch, and they go to certain towns around Guinea, they wow audiences of lots of like complicated acrobatics, but they're kind of not, they're not like in your typical sort of like tights and all this kind of thing. They're just wearing their flip-flops or their like casual clothes to begin with, and they perform in streets and they get a big crowd around, but it looks like it might be quite a spontaneous thing to do, but it's generally quite a planned thing they have going on here. And they train 5 days a week, 6 days a week sometimes in like these like broken sort of like horrible warehouses, which they have there. And they do lots of acrobatics training, and they go to certain towns around Guinea to perform and essentially make a career out of it. And it's quite a nice thing because what the circus does for these youth is rather than going off and doing drugs and all this kind of stuff, it teaches really vital life skills. So one of the things that it's a very, very high sought after to be going into these, to get into the Tinafan Circus. And they are, the skills they pick up are things like focus, creativity, teamwork. And it says like above all, like trust in other people, which is kind of what you need in the circus if you're doing all these acrobatics. But the other thing as well is a sense of belonging and community. And it's very attractive for the youth to be able to have that, because that's maybe some of the foundational reasons of why they go off the trail and get into crime, for example. There's no real sense of belonging. So this adds a healthy way to be able to develop skills and a career away from the heinous crimes and drugs that happen in around the world, let's be honest, but particularly in Guinea. So I think it's quite a good thing they have going on here. And so, for example, a lot of orphan children would go to the circus and train to be acrobats as a way to lead a life as such and have a community. But it goes a bit beyond this. So just a bit into context of how much these have developed over the last 30 or 40 years. So in 1970, there were only 5 of these Tinafan social circuses. However, today there are 500, which is incredible numbers and incredible popularity. It's grown significantly. So much so, actually, even people like the UN have funded these kind of circuses. So actually specifically from the UN Children's Fund and UNICEF, they're really invested in trying to get kids off the streets and get them into some form of a different type of education, sort of like a vocation rather than the standard academic education. So it's funded by UNICEF and then the UN's Children's Fund. So do you know I was saying about where they perform on the streets? Mm-hmm. It has a specific name, this type of event, when they perform on the streets in Guinea, this circus, and it's called the Dundumba.
Dundumba.
The Dundumba, which is quite cool to say. But the reason that it's called this name is because that's the name of the West African drums that accompany them when they're doing their performance.
Oh, that's such a good onomatopoeic name. Yeah. Dundumba. It really sounds like a drum.
Yeah. That's I imagine if you live in a place where the Dundumba is coming, like you could, like an ice cream truck, you can hear it driving and it attracts everyone and wows everyone whilst they're doing like really cool acrobatics and all across these towns of Guinea. I just imagine there would be such a sort of an energetic atmosphere. That also must be really good for society as well. If you're living in a place which is pretty grim, to have something like that turn up in your small town, must be really good for your morale.
Circus rolling through, I love a good street performer. I used to live in Edinburgh, and of course the Edinburgh Fringe is the biggest festival, probably the biggest comedy festival in the world. But outside of the Fringe, you've also got just people turn up in order to chance it. And I remember outside of the cathedral on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh, somebody was there. I think they were doing some kind of juggling act to begin with, and there was a small crowd, and then they pulled out a unicycle, and then the crowd got bigger, and then they started pulling out things like chainsaws and knives.
Holy moly.
And I'm going to Bath as well, where down in the southwest where I used to live, outside the pump room, between the pump room, which isn't your Brighton bathroom.
No, okay. That's a shame.
In between there and the Abbey, there would always be street performers of an evening, and they would do crazy things like sword swallowing and kind of unicycling whilst juggling knives and things like that. But the incredible thing wasn't the act of them doing that. It was always the way that they could create a quick community around them and just draw in 100, 150 people, everybody having the time of their life just watching this guy doing
it. It's a snowballing effect that can happen on the streets really easily.
Yeah.
If there's 50 people watching something, it must be good. And then it just grows.
And so for social cohesion, it just brings everyone together.
So it also reminds me a little bit like the flash mobs that they have, where like suddenly like people just start randomly dancing in the streets or in train stations, and then suddenly everyone's dancing together. People you don't even, you obviously don't know, and it's that sense of community. Because let's be honest, if it's like dancing like a flash mob, everyone can put out a move if they really need to, and if everyone's doing the same thing, it's quite a nice thing all to do together, and particularly when it's quite spontaneous.
Yeah,
as well.
And living in a city is quite weird, going a whole day without seeing somebody that you know until you get back home. So just to bring everyone together. It's such a lovely thing.
I'm so pleased there are so many street performers around the world that do this. And you know what? Out of all things that I would give money to on the streets, that's the kind of thing I would be more inclined to do. I just thought of two, actually. I was once in China, in Beijing, and a street performer of art, and he was using just a water and a brush and doing calligraphy on the floor.
That's cool.
Which is really cool. And not that. And then he would then paint a caricature of me on the floor with this brush.
That's so cool.
Which is so cool.
Yeah.
However, I have maybe thought of the best one.
Yeah.
And you might like this one. I used to live in Brighton, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were walking down the street, and then there was a street performer, and turned to my right, and it is the Ed Sheeran.
Uh-huh.
Performing on the streets before he got his...
Oh, of course, he came from Brighton, didn't he?
Yeah. So he was performing on the streets as busking. And I remember walking by and not knowing who this guy was. And then a year later, after he got to fame, went, holy shit, oh yeah, I know you.
Ron Weasley with a guitar.
Pretty much,
I know you, yeah. How do you feel about busking, though?
I like busking. It's a funny one. So I think it depends. This is going to sound really awful. Has to be good music. You have, and it has to be the right atmosphere as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like you see, like if someone's playing bagpipes in the middle of Duisburg, I'm not going to be too much inclined. But if you're walking, I don't know, if you're walking past somewhere in Scotland and it's a good skilled bagpipe player, then also it's a type of music as well that has to be played.
Yeah,
I think. But I don't like it. I don't like it if it's not particularly that well skilled. But
the bagpipe one is exactly right, because when I was choosing to go to university, it was either Manchester or Edinburgh, and I visited Manchester, and yeah, it was all right, and I've got family in Stockport, but I got the train up to visit Edinburgh with my mum, and I remember coming out of the steps at Waverley Station, which if you've been to Edinburgh, you will know that the steps out of Waverley Station, when you get to the top onto Waverley Bridge, you've got the castle, you've got the Royal Mile, you've got Scott's Monument. And the sun was just setting off to the west. So the sun was setting behind the castle and everything was illuminated in pink and gold. And a bagpipe started playing Scotland the Brave. And I thought,
that works. Okay. That works.
This is me. Yeah.
You need to have the right scene, the right session, the right environment, I think.
I hadn't even been to the university yet.
I see.
No, I'm in.
But that, well, this is the thing. So in Brighton, the problem that you also have is competitive busking. People fighting for space.
Right.
To try and not necessarily make a living, but to be heard.
Yeah.
Because you've got the Brighton Institution of Music there. Institute of Music.
Isn't it?
Yeah, BIM. Mm. And it's huge. And a lot of people just want to be heard there.
Mm.
Quite often in busy places, you will get buskers quite close together. And that's a clash.
Is that why they have to register on the tube?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't get busker wars.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. You don't want any clash of music. Oh, I have seen it before as well. And it's not very pleasant when you've got two buskers next near each other playing different types of music.
And do they acknowledge each other? Do they start aggressively playing a duet?
See, that was how you create the harmony, if they actually just joined together.
Yeah.
And then you're more likely to be seen. They're missing a trick there.
They are missing a trick there.
Idiots.
But life, unfortunately, isn't a musical.
It isn't. Oh, it isn't, no.
Actually, no, life, fortunately, isn't a musical.
I don't think I'm made for musicals, to be totally honest.
I'm going to alienate extra listeners. I cannot stand them. Just go for opera. Either do an opera or a proper play. Don't mess about. Anyway.
Okay. Opinion central here.
That's the weirdest opinion I have, but there you go.
Yeah. I don't have anything as abstract and as passionate as I hate musicals.
That's because you're a normal human being.
Quite a loose term there. Yeah. Do you want to hear about a South African circus where they do a very similar thing?
Go for it.
It's got a different name. It's called Zip Zap.
Zip Zap.
Zip Zap. You said that so lazily. You managed to say Zip Zap's got some zing to it, and you managed to palm it down.
It sounds like a kind of French government agency to me. Le Zip Zap.
I see. Okay. Yeah. It's far from that.
Hang on, let me just try it. Racism. Zip Zap. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, there you go. Like that's it. What it is. Yeah. You need the South African accent for that.
Apologies.
Yeah, but there's a Zip Zap. It's in Cape Town, and they have exactly a similar process here. It's been running again since maybe the 90s, this one. Just before the apartheid ended in South Africa.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. I know, right? But Cape Town being the most affected by the apartheid, it's still a hugely divided city in Cape Town. And there's a still ongoing racial divide within South Africa. It's not beat around the bush here. But the idea of the Zip Zap Circus in South Africa is, again, to try and create an equality across Cape Town, and by training people as acrobats and circus performers, which they have been doing for the last 30 to 35 years. And again, performances around the world. I think they performed in 50 different countries. So it looks like the circus possibly is the way to go in creating harmony and equality around the world. Mm-hmm. Or at least it's an option.
It is an option. Yeah. I mean, that is how you make a society, get kids to do stuff, and then they'll do it for the rest of their life.
And this is one of the final points of the article I read about this. Firstly, there is someone called Mufundisi, who is an acrobat performer at Zip Zap, and he has Zip Zap tattooed in blue ink on his forearm. It's that much ingrained as a community. Uh-huh. It's that bonding.
When you said four, I thought that was going somewhere else.
Well, you have to be really committed if you're going to go that far. I do have the name of the person who set up the ZipZap community, and his name is Brent Van Rensburg.
That's a pretty good South African name.
That's good, yeah. It's definitely, you've set up an Afrikaans sort of South African. Can you do that one? Do you want me to say the name again?
I'd rather you do it. I've already alienated
What's the word you say?
Well, it's racism. Of course it's racism.
Racism.
There you go.
Racism. Brent Van Rensburg.
Yeah, okay.
It kind of works, doesn't it?
Might get the odd letter coming in from Durban.
Hopefully Brent isn't listening to this. He might be totally offended against everything that he's trying to set up. but yeah, so he's the one that set this up. And I think he kind of says to see these kids drive, because obviously the kids are now the next generation. This, he's really pleased that a lot of the kids that were starting when he set it up and now the teachers and the guiders, and he'd like to see this generation push him through. And it's becoming like a vocation, a school, an academic within the circus, in the circus world, but also a proper foundation and a proper institution for circus performers to learn the trade, and which is actually quite cool. Will, I'm ready to learn some history.
Well, boy, are you in luck.
Because my history knowledge gap needs to be filled.
Dear. So I've called this Burn Baby Burn.
Oh.
And it is 9:05 on a cold February evening in 1933 in the middle of Berlin. And if you've been to Berlin in February, you know it is biting cold. We're talking coats, scarves, outer garments and everything. And a police sergeant called Karl Bulwert is walking around the West Central Berlin doing his rounds on this cold February evening when somebody comes running up to him and the man's yelling, "Help, help, 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 help. Someone's broken into the Reichstag and it's on fire." So he rushes over to the Reichstag with this guy and they just kind of stand there thinking, the Reichstag's on fire.
We don't want that to happen.
We do not want that to happen. And someone else turns up and kind of nudges them and says, "What's going on?" And they say, "The Reichstag's on fire." And he looks up and he can see that one of the windows has been smashed in. And behind that, there's a kind of orange glow suggesting that the Reichstag is on fire. But whilst the three of them are looking, they see a figure rush past carrying a torch in his hand. So Bulwert pulls out his gun, fires a bullet in, and then jumps in through the window and starts chasing. The other two head off to go and find a phone to call the fire brigade, and the fire brigade are called because the Reichstag is properly on fire.
Oh my God.
The context for this, what's happening is if you go back a month, January the 30th, the Chancellor of Germany has just changed for the fourth time in a year. And the most recent option, who was picked by President Paul von Hindenburg, or Hindenburg as we would call him in English, was Adolf Hitler. Ah. Hitler has just become Chancellor a month earlier. And the way he becomes Chancellor is extremely convoluted and complicated, but it essentially comes down to a couple of people who think that they are the best person in Germany, a guy called Franz von Papen and Kurt von Schleicher. Von Schleicher, by the way, means sneaky boy. Schleichen in German.
Bootykins.
Not Bootykins this time, no, sneaky boy. Schleicher means sneaker. Okay. So they kind of have a year-long tiff where they're both negotiating for power, trying to manipulate the president, Paul von Hindenburg, who is 82 years old and wants to leave a good legacy for everyone when he dies, to become chancellor. Von Papen, von Schleicher both want to become chancellor. And the way that they both try and become chancellor is to use the Nazis as pawns. They believe that they are so manipulative.
Right.
So they can play the Nazis off against the other party, not realizing that underneath it all, you're dealing with Adolf Hitler, who, whilst he does have some quite obvious blind spots in his intelligence, is very cunning and is a master political manipulator. So by the end of it, by January 1933, von Papen's been chancellor and was fired. Schleicher's been chancellor and was fired. And so the only man left is Adolf Hitler.
Okay.
And basically how Hitler gets to power is, there's some long-term causes, of course, but within 1932 to 1933, he just waits. And he lets everybody play their cards, and they've all got crap hands, and he's waiting with the ace in the hole to just play his card at exactly the right time.
And he wins.
And he wins. And that's how he becomes Chancellor. So we've got the Nazis as Chancellor, the Nazis kind of in power, Hitler as Chancellor. But the problem is the Reichstag that he has doesn't have enough Nazis in it for him to be able to pass laws. So Hitler needs a way to be able to pass laws. So back to February the 27th.
The Reichstag's on fire.
The Reichstag's on fire. And the fire brigade do arrive. But by the time they've arrived, it's burnt out. It's a complete shell of a building.
So the whole building gone?
Whole building gone, pretty much. Can't be used anymore.
Oh my God.
And so when the fire's been put out, the police head into the Reichstag and they find a man in there who's been kind of waiting it out.
It's not Hitler, is it? He was waiting.
It's not Hitler. No, it's not. It's not the worst Kinder Egg ever. It's Hitler. No, it's a Dutch guy.
That is the terrible Kinder Egg to have.
What do you get? I got a hippo. I got a crocodile. I got Adolf Hitler. So that's why they're banned in the US. So no, it's a Dutch guy, a little 24-year-old Dutch guy called Marinus van der Lubbe. And he's partly blind because in an industrial accident, he managed to get some lime in his eyes. And that's not lime that you'd put into a gin tonic.
Okay, this is the stone.
Yeah, this is the stone.
Yeah, kind of... you get like Lime Lake, sometimes they have this green tint, don't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's some in Kent.
Are there?
Yes. There you go. In a place, you're like this, in a town called Snodland.
Snodland, that's what goes on in Snodland. I always wondered.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't sound normal.
Not normal, with cement works and the Lime Lake.
Right, I see. And lime's quite nasty.
It's horrible.
Yeah. You don't want to get it in your eyes.
No.
And he does, and he has to retire.
Oh.
At the age of about 20. And so because he's retired at the age of 20 through this horrible work accident, mm-hmm. he decides he's going to dedicate his life to fighting for rights for workers. And the best way to do that in the 1930s is to join the Communist Party. So the man that they find in the building is a communist called Marinus van der Lubbe. And for the Nazis, this is a birthday present come early. This is a golden opportunity for them because... what they've got is a terrorist who's attacking German democracy. And what that means is there is a communist revolution afoot and we've got to do everything we can to stop the communist revolution. So for the Nazis, the fact that the Reichstag is burned down, excellent. Because Hitler gets immediately on the phone to Hindenburg, the president, and he gets the president to pass something called Article 48. Now, anybody who's done GCSE history within the last 2 years will have had Article 48 drummed into them, because what it is it's a key part of the Weimar Constitution.
Right, okay.
Do you know anything about Weimar Germany?
No.
Okay, after the First World War, get rid of the Kaiser.
Yep.
And we need to replace it with a new system. And between 1918 and 1923, Germany is a complete anarchic mess. There is a democratic government, but they can't set up in Berlin, which, as you said before, was the historical capital of,
yes.
Certainly of parts of Germany, because Berlin's a complete war-torn mess, and it's simply too dangerous. So instead, they relocate to a city outside of Berlin called Weimar, and that's why it's called the Weimar government, because the government cannot work in Berlin. It's full of communists and fascists fighting each other. But this government that comes into power, they manage to create a very modern democratic system. And between 1919 and the Nazis, you have free elections and free speech, and everybody has the right to vote. And there are separate powers, and there's proportional representation. So it's a proper modern democracy, more modern than some European democracies today. But within this constitution, you also have Article 48. And what Article 48 of the constitution says is that the president, in the case of an emergency, can suspend the constitution completely.
Oh.
And rule by decree. It's a loophole. And it means that the first president, Friedrich Ebert, who's a bit of a hero in Germany, there's Ebertstrasse everywhere.
There's loads of those around,
I think. You probably go past two on your way to work.
I think
there's one here and there's one.
I have noticed it before.
At the risk of doxing you.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, it's so common in Germany that that doesn't tell us anything. There are Ebertstrasses in every town.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's the first president of the Weimar Republic. He uses this Article 48 to rule by decree, to become a dictator, 136 times.
What?
136 times.
This isn't number time, but wow.
It's not number time, but it is now. So it's quite a common thing to do. So we do have a modern democracy where everybody has the right to vote, But on the other hand, we do also have a pseudo-dictatorship where the president can just do whatever he wants. Now, if you're Adolf Hitler and you need a state of emergency to do whatever you want in Germany, well, you've just had a communist burn down the Reichstag. And so what he does on the day after, literally the day after the Reichstag burns down, is he gets on the phone to Hindenburg and he says, you need to suspend the democracy because Germany is under attack.
Oh, wow.
And using this law, the very next day, February the 28th, 1933, the Nazis, using Article 48, there's no chance for the Reichstag to stand against it because there's no vote. They pass a law, and this law bans free speech. It bans free press. It bans public assembly. It bans secret post offices. It bans secret telephone calls.
God.
It goes so far as to ban the process of habeas corpus. And habeas corpus is an ancient legal right, which is common to every single democracy in the world. In the UK, it's been around since the Magna Carta.
Right.
That's how old it is. And what that is you cannot be detained unlawfully. If you're arrested, then you must have a trial. That's habeas corpus.
Right.
Because of the Reichstag fire, the Nazis can suspend even that.
Oh, my God.
And so within 24 hours, because of the Reichstag burning down, the Nazis can jump on this opportunity and turn Germany from the free democratic country it was in the 1920s to the pure dictatorship that it is in the 1930s.
Christ
almighty.
Just based
on one single incident. And the powers that this gives to Hitler also allow him, because he can now suspend habeas corpus, he can arrest who he wants. Nobody can do anything about it. So he simply arrests every single communist member of the Reichstag, every single member of the Communist Party that he can get his hands on, and anybody who might vote for the communists, which means that the vote that's going to take place on March the 5th, the one that they've had to do to get their own kind of government after Hitler's chancellor, they can simply destroy the communists.
Wow.
And the Nazis go from having about 30% of the vote to 44% of the vote, which means that with a little bit of negotiations with their allies, they've now got a majority government. And with that majority government, they can rewrite the constitution and they can make Hitler basically president and chancellor at the same time. You have a dictatorship.
That's terrifying. And that happens in the space of what? A couple of days or a day?
It's a week.
A week.
So the fire is on the 27th. The Reichstag Fire Act is passed the next day, which bans free speech, bans secret telephones calls,
yeah,
bans habeas corpus, and the election takes place on March the 5th.
Oh, my week God. Later. And just take me, right, so the in Germany, people were for the Nazi Party. They liked...
Some people were, but the vast majority weren't, because this is how a proportional representation system works, that you... It's the same kind of system that you have in Germany today.
Yes.
That you have many, many small parties and you never have a majority government, because the idea behind it is if you have a majority government, then you're overruling the minority who didn't vote for them in a way that's completely unfair. Mm-hmm. So for example, if we think of the Conservative government in the United Kingdom,
yes,
they got somewhere around 35% of the vote. I'm not sure entirely, but it's something about 35% of Brits voted for them. And yet they have a clear majority of over 80 seats in the Houses of Parliament.
And that's the first past the post method,
isn't
it?
That's first past the post, same in the United States. So that means 65% of people in the United Kingdom, of voters in the United Kingdom, not just people, but voters, did not vote for the government in the United Kingdom. And yet 100% of the laws within this current term of Parliament will be written by that party.
It seems very old-fashioned and unfair, this method of governance.
Completely unfair.
Yeah.
But the thing is, with a proportional representation system, is that because you can vote your heart, you can vote for whoever you want, and there will be fringe minority parties. I mean, in Germany, there are elections going on now, and if you walk around, especially the student parts of Duisburg, you'll see posters up for the Marxist-Leninist Party of Germany,
yes,
which still exist.
I have seen that, yes.
And you'll also see posters up for the Alternative for Germany, AfD, who are massively popular in some parts of Germany, but essentially the BNP.
Yeah.
And the thing is, by using a proportionally representative system, you are giving a voice to these fringe parties. So you get all the benefits of having coalitions that people actually want, like the current coalition in Germany, mm-hmm, but you do also have the fringe parties.
Yeah, and that's where some of the I'm right in saying that's where some of the extremist parties will have an opportunity to be able to get into the government.
Exactly. Germany did fix that, whereby I think I'm right in saying you need at least 5% of the vote to have a single seat in the Reichstag today, which wasn't the case under the Weimar government.
Okay.
But yeah, it does open the door to extremism. And it means that, I mean, the thing is, and the one of the key takeaways of the story of how does Germany become a Nazi dictatorship is democracy only works if people play by the rules. And the minute you stop playing by the rules, you may as well get rid of the whole thing. Because you have to believe in the rules for the rules to apply. And if you say, actually, the rules don't apply to some people, but they do apply to others, well, now you have a system where you can pick and choose which rules you think apply. Mm-hmm. And if you think, I'm not going to listen to that rule because I don't believe in that rule, so I'm not going to listen to it.
Then the whole of democracy just kind of breaks down.
Then why would you listen to any rules that go against what you want?
Exactly. Germany famous for rules.
Yeah, but you can kind of see why.
Yeah, you get it.
They learned their lesson. Because if you think, actually, I don't want to listen to that rule, then this is the kind of situation you end up in. So Germany ends up a dictatorship. By the time of the Reichstag fire, it is always too late. The Nazis were going to do this. The real turning point is, well, that's an argument for another day.
Yeah.
That's a piece of GCSE coursework.
So anyone who needs the GCSE coursework, if you've listened to this segment.
You're welcome.
I have one question though. Yeah. And you talked about Berlin in 1920, 1930. Mm. Wasn't Berlin a really awesome place to live about 1910?
Yeah. So it's
insanely
before
fun.
The First World War, it's okay. The early 1920s, it's horrific because you've got the Spartacists fighting the Freikorps. You've got Rosa Luxemburg, who there's many Rosa Luxemburg streets in Germany because she's a bit of a darling of the socialists and the communists. But you've also got people like Wolfgang Kapp, who is just an out-and-out fascist.
Right.
So you've got civil war on the streets in Berlin, but under a guy called Gustav Stresemann in the 1920s, Germany's kind of fixed to an extent. The worst parts of the Treaty of Versailles that crippled Germany after the First World War were renegotiated in a more beneficial way. Germany signs a whole load of foreign policy treaties that bring it back to the table in many different ways. And that means by the time you get to 1924, then Berlin's booming. And it really is boomtown. It's like Vienna 20 years earlier or Paris at the same time.
Well, this is what I've heard, like, it's like anything kind of goes. It was like lots of, and one of the things, remember, homosexuality was not a problem.
No.
For example, people just did what they wanted. Absolutely. And everyone was okay with it.
This is the thing about studying Germany in the 20s and 30s. The Nazis, they didn't come from nowhere, but they did take over a country that looks like many countries that we would consider to be stable democracies today.
Yeah.
The Weimar government was, or the Weimar Germany was the number one cultural country in the world. I mean, the reason why Hollywood takes off so much in the 1930s is because all of the German directors who were Jewish in Berlin in the 1920s fled to Hollywood.
I see.
That's one of the reasons why it kicks off. There are other reasons, and we'll talk about it more in the future, I'm sure. But film, as we know it, is very much a product of 1920s Germany. As is musicals, as we know them, as is modern theatre under Bertolt Brecht, as is looking around your lovely apartment, I can see so many items of furniture that come directly from the Bauhaus influence.
Yes.
Which is Weimar Germany.
Oh, okay.
So it really was the cultural capital of the world.
The epicentre of cultural boomingness.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's what people always say to me, if you would go back to a place in time, I'm glad you've explained this because people say that if you would like to go back to any place in time to experience or to live, usually my answer is like 1920s Berlin.
Yeah.
That would be just incredible to live at that time.
Absolutely. And that's why the threat of the Nazis looming on the horizon is so terrifying, because if it can happen to Berlin in the 1920s, we might not think of Germany as a very militaristic country. I mean, they were certainly responsible for escalating the First World War. The Franco-Prussian War was horrific in the 1870s, but Berlin in the 1920s was the cultural place to be. And so if it can happen there...
It can happen anywhere.
As the title of the novel is, yeah.
See.
So to round off the story, van der Lubbe was arrested and found guilty, and he was guillotined within the year.
Okay. Was he put on trial?
He was put on trial. But of course, it's the Nazis, so it's not a real trial.
Okay, a pseudo trial.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, it's so much of a pseudo trial that something that I found out when researching for this is that in 1998, the German government passed a law that said that anybody who had been found guilty of any crime by the Nazis was innocent. because the Nazis didn't have the legal ability to pass laws.
Oh, okay. I see.
Oh, wow.
And to find people guilty. So he was found innocent in 2008 using this law from 1998 because you couldn't commit a crime against the Nazis because they themselves were illegitimate.
Wow.
Which is a funny way of doing your national history.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there have been some conspiracies around this that it's so fortuitous for the Nazis to have a communist burning the Reichstag. I mean, it's a bit on the nose. How are you going to destroy German democracy? Burn down the House of Parliament.
Yeah, exactly. Burn down where everything parliamentary happens. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, conspiracy theory, ahoy.
Yes.
But the thing is, van der Lubbe was a bit of an arson. He did this a lot. And
probably got a kick out of it.
He did, very much so. And he'd always been involved in the communist underground.
Okay.
And so the historical consensus is he was acting alone, for sure. It was just fortuitous for the Nazis.
Just going to head out to Reichstag. What are you doing? Wait and see.
And what's your end game here? Well, I'm going to burn it down, then the communists are going to win. Do you think you're missing a few steps then, Marina? No.
No. You watch.
You watch. This is going to go so well.
It's going to go like a house on fire.
So how does democracy end in a country? It just takes a single spark and it all goes up in flames.
Hey, Will, it's number time.
Number time.
So I'm going to give you a number and a clue, mm-hmm. and I want to see if you can try and work out the link between the two.
You want to watch me flounder like a stuck fish.
Yeah. Have you been successful with number time so far? I don't think none of us have, we?
You kind of tease me along like a tickled trout, and I sometimes get there.
well phrased.
Thank you.
We'll see if we can tickle this trout further. Okay. So my number is $2,000.
Okay.
And goats.
Right. Well, obviously the correct answer is not how much does a goat cost in US dollars.
No. I don't know how much it would cost actually to have a goat. I would hope it'd be a bit cheaper than $2,000.
Really?
I don't know.
I mean, that's... $2,000, like...
That's how much a Dalmatian cost.
Exactly. Yeah. So, what if it's a really good goat? You know, really screams in a really surprising way.
Well, as it could be the greatest of all time.
Oh.
God. Would you like an extra clue before you...
Boom, boom. I'd like to get out of here.
Well, I'll give you the extra clue, and it's Kashmir and Pashmina.
Right. Okay. So, obviously, they're kinds of wool. Mm-hmm. So, are we talking, this is the price of that wool per some unit of measurement?
Yeah, you're on the right track there.
Okay.
So, I don't actually have the unit of measurement, but for the Pashmir, the Pashmina and Kashmir wool of these particular goats we're going to talk about, they are known as luxury goods, mm-hmm. and they can retail from $200 up to $2,000. For a particular item of clothing.
Right, okay.
So that's where we're at. But we're particularly focusing on these type of goats.
So they are good goats.
They're pretty. So you were right when you said they were good goats.
Top
quality goats. And we're going to find out, or I'm going to tell you, why they are top quality goats. And then again, as geography often does, goes into a very sad story.
Oh dear.
About the future of these goats.
Oh dear.
So we are in India again.
Okay. There's no goat circuses at the end of this. There's no zip zap for goats.
No, you haven't read my notes properly this time round. There are no goat circuses, but...
It's a sad story. Okay, yeah, here we go.
But we are 4,000 metres at an altitude, mm-hmm. and a temperature of minus 40 degrees Celsius.
Are we by any chance in Kashmir?
We're on the Changtang Plateau.
Okay.
And that's northern India.
Yeah.
So we're on literally the border between kind of China and India.
Right.
Do you know much about the border between China and India?
Is that the one that, depending on where you are in the world, like if you've got a VPN and look it up from India, then the border will be in one place. And then if you look it up from China, the border will be in another place.
Yeah, disputed territories, Tibet and all this kind of thing up there. Because obviously China wants Tibet just in case India takes it and then they invade. Mm-hmm. Essentially,
Strategic yaks or something?
Yeah, pretty much.
Massive resource pool of Buddhists they've got in Tibet. What are you doing with Tibet?
Yeah, there's nothing really there, to be
honest.
People
have kind of given up on that, but... I'm not going to alienate the Chinese. No,
can you imagine if we just start talking about trying to work out Tibet on a podcast? I think there's going to be a whole Oh, whole kettle of fish.
Kettle of worms.
That's what I was going to say, kettle of worms. Anyways, but we're talking about goats. There are some goats called the Changtangi goats.
These goats have
extremely thick wool.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean thick. When I say thick, let me rephrase it.
You mean thick with two C's, don't you?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I'm going for. But they have their hair is, or their fur, for each strand is 8 to 10 microns in width.
Okay.
Does that mean anything to you?
Do you know what? It kind of does. Can I tell you why?
Why? Yeah,
because we've just done something about ancient Egypt with my year 8.
Mm.
And one of the things was Tutankhamun's coffin. And he had a 4-layered coffin, and the inside was solid gold, but the outermost coffin was wood with a layer of gold leaf on it.
Right.
And these ancient Egyptian craftsmen were so skilled that they could beat the gold leaf to 18 microns thick.
Oh, wow.
Which is about the thickness of cling film. So if 18 microns is the thickness of cling film, which is just extraordinary.
That's incredible.
Like 3,000 years ago, they can do that. But that means that's twice as thick as these... very, very fine goat hair, half the thickness of cling film.
Yeah, half the thickness of cling film. And altogether, that means that it is 8 times warmer than sheep's wool.
Right.
So we're talking pretty, you know, if you live in this place and you've got these goats, you need to put this wool on.
Roasty toasty.
Yeah, if it's minus 40 degrees Celsius.
Okay. Right.
Which
that makes
coincidentally
sense.
Is minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah. That's the conversion point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. That's saying a bit. Number time.
That's what we're doing here, people. Yeah.
So we're talking about Changtangi goats. They sometimes called the Changra goats, and there are some herders up there in the Changtang Plateau.
Okay.
And now, if we're talking about obviously the the minus 40 degrees and it needs to be cold, can you imagine what direction I'm going in geography related here?
Is it that massive, dense, black pit of depression at the bottom of my stomach called climate change?
It is, exactly that.
Hey, take a drink, people.
Yes. We are talking about climate change. So the concept here is that in these regions, so we're in the Changtang Plateau, and it's in the northern India. You obviously have the Himalayas, the highest mountain range of the world. It's where Mount Everest or Mount Everest, that's sometimes called it there,
or,
I think.
Chumalungma, as it's known as by the locals, I believe.
That's come straight from your brain. I'm very impressed that you know that. But we talked about climate change. There are other threats to this wool, by the way. Climate change is the biggest threat. But one of the other biggest threats is fake Pashmir imports from China and the increased importance placed on education. So we're talking about maybe the youth in this area again wanting to migrate to cities instead of continuing generational goat herding and rearing. But the biggest threat is climate change. And what we have here is in the winter months, they are having too much snow in February and January, meaning that these goats that they're rearing up there, they can't feed. So as a result, they're having to migrate to other places, and there's higher competition for land for these goats to be able to graze the land. And if you know anything about crop rotations, if you don't have a sort of stable land to do crop rotation on, you're going to completely eradicate all of your grass and grazing land for your goats to survive on. And it's been known that these goats in northern India have been dying of starvation because there is not enough food up there to sustain so many of them. The other thing they have is, so they basically have an extreme weather differences in northern India. So there's, bizarrely, this is a misconception we'll have to discuss in the future. Climate change doesn't necessarily mean it gets warm everywhere around the world at the same time. There are some places it gets colder as well. But in some of the months as well, in a sort of post-winter time, it becomes too warm as well. And there's not enough snow. So we have sort of turbulent weather patterns.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's all messed up, and it's not consistent enough to be able to consistently rear these goats to be able to produce enough of this wool to then meet the demand, which is around the world.
Yeah.
That's the problem. There are other problems where I think they... there are 50 communities of these goat herders in northern India, and there it's kind of reduced now down to like 16 or 15 because a lot of people are now, again, youth don't want the hardship of being able to make this wall where they are heading down into New Delhi and other parts of like Mumbai to get these tertiary type of jobs in cities, which is, you know, attractive if you're a youth and want to have a sustainable income rather than a turbulent income, which... these goat herders are experiencing at the moment.
It's the same thing as with the rituals last week, isn't it?
Yes, it's that kind of thing.
Why would you do an outdated, horrific job that will cost you your body when you can spend a couple of years at uni and get a much better paying job that won't?
Exactly. No, exactly. And why? And then you can just send your money back home as well to your family, what they call a sort of domestic remittance kind of money.
Yeah.
It's that same concept again. But unfortunately, this has been triggered rather than it was coronavirus and governance last week or last time. This is more to do with climate change, which, let's be honest, as human beings on this planet, we have contributed.
We've messed it up, Roy.
Incredibly. Absolutely incredibly. Yeah, it's crazy. But there has been some effort from the, and you'll like this, from the India's Ministry of Textiles.
Okay, excellent.
But they've identified the problem, and what they do, they provided $1.2 million, and for each herder, they are given 50 of these animals to be able to support these herders, to be able to try and keep this business running. So as a way to try and sustain this way of life in northern India, which is, you know, a sensible thing to do, I think. There was support also from the World Bank. The World Bank got involved to do this as well. So, you know, it's because a lot of member states around countries around the world are members of the World Bank in times of crisis. No matter how big or small the crisis is, you can kind of get your deposit from the World Bank if you want to. Depends how much you kind of pay into it with your GDP, actually, is that by how much you can take out as well. Yeah. So like USA has a huge weighting in it, for example. Yeah. But that's how the World Bank works. India's Ministry of Textiles are trying to help. However, there's been such a strain on being able to get the raw resources to be able to make these products that they've had to have further imports from Mongolia and China to be able to subsidize the losses that they're experiencing in northern India. But let's be honest, the relationship between India and China isn't... It's not meant to be so great. There's one small war, I think, in the 50s between the two countries.
Mm-hmm. And there are constant border spats now. I mean,
yeah.
If you were to look at the news from the past year, you'll find many examples of the odd Indian or the odd Chinese soldier being killed on the border. They are... it's a tense relationship for sure.
But bound by geography in the sense that there's
massive
mountain range in the middle. There is a solution to this
problem.
To
climate change? Thank God. What have you told anyone, Reece?
I have the magic key to climate change. I don't, unfortunately. But there is a solution for the Changpa herders, which is what they're called, by the way. There is a solution. But if I just, let me outline the solution to you and see what you think of it.
Is it electric goats? With
the they have to pay for heavy amounts of rupees. No. So the idea is that, I want to see if you like this or not, because I don't think they do. But the idea is that they're trying to essentially breed the perfect goat in China.
Right.
By, you know, genetics and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
To be able to make the perfect goat, which can then be used to then make the best wool on larger scales, essentially. So we're trying to genetically modify here a goat, which can then reproduce more goats and more goats of the best quality, but also at a larger scale. But as you can imagine, the Changpa herders say, that's not authentic.
That's not how it works.
That's not how we do it here. We don't want to have your genetically modified goat to be able, to help us do our craft. It was actually put together by or suggested by a university that in India. They were trying to fund this to be able to get the perfect goat for the perfect Kashmir style wool. But the Changpa herders don't like it. They said it goes against their Buddhist beliefs.
Right,
that it has to be authentic and natural, and we don't want your genetically modified goats to be able to produce the wool. We would rather have absolutely nothing than your stupid genetically modified goats.
Which is interesting because spider goat, have you heard of spider goat?
No, I've heard of spider pig.
Spider pig does whatever a spider pig does.
Yeah.
Spider goat is a real thing where it's a genetically modified goat. And what they've done is they've spliced goat DNA with the specific part of spider DNA that generates silk. And so what do spiders create? They create silk, don't they?
Yeah, it's silk, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's silk.
Bees
it is.
Create honey. Earwigs create Marmite, spiders create silk.
Got it.
Yes. So what that means is that when you milk this goat, the milk will have these spidery silk fibers in it. And so you can use that to then spin spider webs, but in a usable fabric.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
We've got biochemistry. What's this all about?
That's... Can we just stop as a race? Can we just knock it off for 10 minutes?
Yeah. Just calm down.
Weird.
How just go to the petrol station, just chill a little, just off the services, take a breather.
Exactly.
But just to round it off, if there is a way to round this off. So there is obviously a economic threat to the Changbas, which is the
because herders. They don't have it hard enough already.
Already, I know. But there is climate change is having an impact on them and their unique culture is under threat. Unfortunately, we need to look after our minority cultures, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, in the Western world, we are so used to modernism and industrialization that it's not a big deal. But the thing is, we simply exported our need for food and growing stuff to other countries.
Yeah.
And now they're doing exactly the same thing. And so where is the food going to be grown? Where
exactly.
Are things going to come from in the future?
Because and you have the other side as well, is have you heard of something called virtual water before?
Virtual water?
Virtual water. We're not in the metaverse, by the way.
Jesus.
Virtual water.
It's going to make me angry, isn't it?
It's going to make you angry. Okay. So let's say, for example, that you wanted to manufacture some shirts for mm-hmm. your company, Primark, for example.
Yep.
You send all of your stuff to Malaysia. Yeah. And then they have to use significant amounts of fresh water to be able to make your product. So you are draining their fresh water supply and you're not draining your own. So you're right. Using so many liters of virtual water.
It's like, there will be blood. Just, I drink your milkshake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So yeah, I am angry.
There you go. So be angry for the right reasons.
Thank you. Roll the music. My number this week is 7,848.
Let me just type that down.
And the topic is ancient Mesopotamia.
Oh God.
You're not going to get this in a million years.
Whoa. Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
What is it?
Mesopotamia is Greek for between two rivers. And okay. Those rivers are the Tigris and the Euphrates. So we're talking modern day Iraq.
Ah, okay. Yes. I know the river that runs through there. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, okay. What was the number again?
7,848.
I wanted to say how many liters per second go past in this... Riverway.
No, that would be geography.
Yeah, that's geography, isn't it? That doesn't work, is it?
You know me better than that.
Okay, can I have my extra clue? I'm generally stumped.
This is 7,848 modern people doing something about ancient Mesopotamia.
I've
got a third clue if you want.
Okay. They're not building a bridge, are they?
They are not building a bridge.
Okay. That was my feeble attempt at something here. Is there a third clue?
There is. It's to do with Facebook.
Oh, what? Hang on. We were taking me on some journey here. So it was ancient Greece,
Mesopotamia, Iraq.
And then Facebook.
Yeah. 7,848 modern day people doing something on Facebook about ancient Mesopotamia.
I don't know. Is it something like, is there a Facebook group or something where these people are all joined to?
Yes. And that Facebook group is about, the interesting thing about it is it's about a single pottery tablet that we have. And it's people making stupid memes about this single clay tablet.
Oh, really?
There are on the internet, as we speak, 7,848 people making quite funny, very stupid jokes about a single pottery tablet.
Wow. Can I just say to the listener very quickly?
Yeah.
You might think sometimes when I suddenly hit on the right answer number time that Will was giving me a proper suggestion off the mic. He gave me nothing for that Facebook group idea.
Absolutely
I come
nothing.
With that on myself. And to be honest, I literally had no idea what any of those numbers and things were about. That was a real stab in the dark.
If you can imagine you just asked a dog to do your taxes. That's kind of how Reese was looking throughout that.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate, actually. Yeah.
So, of course, the question is, what the hell is on this tablet that's
so
interesting?
Yeah, that's what I want to know, yeah.
Let me read it to you. It starts out, to Ea Nasir, which is a guy's name, Nasir, mm-hmm. from Nani, which is a guy's name. You told me you had fine copper. You gave my courier bad copper. And you said, take it or leave it. If you don't want it, sod off. What do you take me for that you treat somebody like me with such contempt? I've sent you money, I've sent you couriers, but you have sent me nothing. And all of that through enemy territory as well. No one else treats me like this. You took my money. You didn't give me my copper. It's now up to you to give me back my money. From now on, I will never do business with you unless you give me the best copper. And that's it.
And I just want to say, how many likes did that get?
But what I love about that is that you could see that on like Yelp or something or on Google reviews.
Yeah.
And yet that is 4,000 years old.
Oh, so this is like one star.
Yeah, this is a one star review from about 1700 years before Christ. So this is the Iliad and the Odyssey that we've spoken about before.
Yes.
That was written about, well, composed-ish about 800 BC. This is 1700 BC. This is 1,000 years before the Iliad and the Odyssey. The pyramids were fairly new when this was written. That's how old we're talking here. And the weird thing about this is the only reason we have this clay tablet is because it was sent by this guy Nani to this guy Eanasir. Eanasir kept it. And it's not the only one he kept. He kept dozens of these complaint tablets about how bad he was at selling copper.
Oh, right. So he wasn't even using them to better himself.
No, yet. No, not at all. He was just some grumpy curmudgeon selling crap copper. And because the way the writing would work back then is it would be imprinted into clay. And normally the reason there is that with clay, you just add water to it and you can mold it again. You've got a new sheet of paper, essentially.
Right.
But there must have been a fire at this guy's house at some point that was at exactly the right temperature to perfectly bake these clay tablets. And if you go to the British Museum, why the British Museum? Because we steal everything.
We steal everything, of course.
Absolutely
yeah.
Everything. Yeah. I still can't quite get over the fact that someone went to the Parthenon in Athens and said, fucking having that. And did.
Just took it.
And now we won't give it back.
Yeah.
Because why would you? Find the keepers. So they're all in the British Museum. You can go and read them. And
we're terrible people, British, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. But this guy just decided to keep all of his negative one-star reviews. And I just love the idea that 4,000 years ago, this guy of an evening would, what should I do this evening? Shall I go and see some wrestling in the town square? Shall I listen to some poets? No, I'm going to read all my terrible reviews.
Did he not have any good reviews, or did he just like bin them?
That's the thing. He's really bad at selling copper, so he doesn't have a single good review, as far as we know. And so you can kind of see why it becomes a meme. And if you go onto this webpage, it is just like all of the modern meme templates, but using complaints about copper.
Oh, wow.
And you can buy a t-shirt that says, I went to Eanir's copper shop and all I got was contempt and hatred.
This is great. I didn't know anything about that. That's fantastic. Yeah. Oh, wow. I just love this idea that he didn't reflect on his own practice and just decided, I'm really bad at selling copper. I just need to certify that by reading my reviews again. They're not even like a 2-star review.
No.
It was all right, but there were some problems.
Yeah. So. No, it's give me my money. Yeah. You sent me shit copper again. I've had to cross enemy territory. My courier almost got killed.
The other thing as well is, did he have the same customer again?
This isn't the only one we've got from Nani.
Okay.
So if anything, this is on Nani.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, he had repeat business. Yeah. So
we should go back.
That's the thing. We are missing the tablet that says, Dear Eanasir, clearly I'm the mug here.
Yeah. So it hasn't been shared enough. That's
exactly. Yeah. So I just love these little slices of life where you can glimpse into the abyss of history. And what you see is just laughing and making money off a scam 4,000 years ago.
Do you know what, right? It's a part of me that's so warming that some of the problems that we have today, which are so trivial as well, it's so nice to hear that it existed 4,000 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. Human beings are human beings. And we could be dropped 10,000 years ago into the middle of the Ice Age and everybody would be wearing different clothes and looking different, living in different places. They'd still laugh at butt jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
And they'd still complain about somebody giving them poor quality furs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there'll be dicks graffitied on the wall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Human beings are human beings.
We don't change, really.
We don't.
On a sort of a foundation level.
We don't. No, we are our ancestors very fundamentally, and we can wear fancy clothing, but ultimately...
When someone says Willy, it's really funny.
It's pretty good. It is. And some of the most ancient jokes that we have are from ancient Babylon, from a little bit later than this. They're all dick jokes.
Excellent.
And fart jokes.
Oh.
Yeah. So
secretly British and Australian then.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to join this Facebook group and be the 7,849th member, it's called Complaint Tablet to Air Nastier Memes for Teens Who Are Not of Good Quality. So enjoy.
Well, that might be worth a tweet.
Yeah. But that's not the only Facebook group you should be joining, because far better is, of course, the Gaps in Knowledge Facebook group. So give us a search as well, or you can email us gapsinknowledge@outlook.com.
Yeah, and you can also find us on YouTube, which is Gaps in Knowledge Podcast, and you can also find us on Twitter @GapsPodcast. Yeah, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed, and I suppose the best thing you can do, as we always say, is tell a friend if you like this.
Yeah, pass it on, share the love, and ta-ra for now.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Drink. I do this sometimes.
Clearly one of us is losing their mind here. Not sure. I think you're trying to drag me down with you.
That's how it is, yes.
We're 1 week into term. You can't. I can't. It's a week 7 or 8 type of.
That's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh dear.